I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Dwight D. Eisenhower was not known to have a raucous sense of humor, but he understood its value by saying, quote, "A sense of humor is part of the art of leadership, of getting along with people, of getting things done." Well, there is a place for humor and laughter at work, but cracking jokes can come with risks of offending others, of going too far, of missing the mark, of making the jokester look foolish and unserious. Our guests, Maurice Schweitzer and Brad Bitterly, have studied how humor can enhance a person's status and influence how others perceive their competence and self-confidence on the job. They wrote a research paper last year, Risky Business, When Humor Increases and Decreases Status, and one this summer, The Impression Management Benefits of Humorous Self-Disclosure. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Maurice Schweitzer. He's a professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Wrote a book a couple of years ago, or co-authored a book a couple of years ago, Friend and Foe. Maurice Schweitzer, nice to have you back with us from Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. And joining us by ISDN from the University of Michigan Studios is Brad Bitterly, and he is a postdoctoral research fellow. Brad Bitterly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Well, to set the stage, set the mood, here's Rob Schneider playing his Richard Richmeister character on Saturday Night Live.
Steve and Sandy, making copies. The Steve Man and the Sandster, making copies.
Who is this guy? Do you know him?
Don't worry about him. That's just Richard Lamer. It's just his way of trying to be nice. Hi, Richard.
The Sandster saying hi. Sandy and Steve.
It's kind of annoying. Maybe somebody ought to talk to him.
Steve-a-rama. Steve-a-ramovich.
We've all tried. There's nothing we can do. Thank you.
All right. Steve-o's finished with the copies. Sandy's turn. Sandita.
Maurice Schweitzer, does every office have a Richard character?
Not every office does. Maybe every office should.
You think so? Even though he seemed to be irritating most of his coworkers there?
Yeah, there's definitely boundaries around humor. So we can make mistakes with humor by going too far with it. So some humor is good. And, you know, in this clip, you know, somebody just won't turn it off.
Exactly.
That's a problem. And there are other mistakes we can make with humor. One is sometimes we cross a line and become too offensive. So humor is funny when it's edgy, but not too edgy. And so here, those are, you know, sort of two ways that humor could fail. A third way humor could fail is just by not being edgy enough, by being so bland that it just falls flat. So there are a few ways that humor can get us into trouble. I think the most concerning one is when people cross the line, it becomes offensive.
Sure. And I'm going to pick up on all of that. Brad, let me get you in on the conversation. Curious about how the two of you got interested in the use of humor in the workplace.
Well, what really motivated the investigation is the fact that humor is this behavior that pervades our interactions. And when we took a look around, we saw that it was really significantly shaping and molding the way that we interact and the way that we view each other. But despite this fact, humor has been shockingly absent from the prior organizational behavior research. And we thought that this was a grave omission, and we really wanted to actually fill that hole.
Is that because when you're at work, you're supposed to be working and not cracking jokes, Brad?
I think that is what motivates it. I think we have this association where work is supposed to be the serious place where we just get things done. And as a result, we've viewed humor as separate and ancillary to working and actually being productive. But what we find is that that's not the case, and it can actually have tremendous benefits in the workplace.
Yeah, I'm curious, what are the benefits of humor in the workplace, Maurice?
Well, I'd say just, to sort of pick up on what Brad's saying, is that humor is really pervasive. It's difficult to imagine almost any conversation we have with people that doesn't have some piece of humor somewhere. And there are many benefits. That is, we're able to communicate ideas through humor, sometimes in a less threatening way. Sometimes humor allows us to shape ideas or to prime people to be more receptive to something. So we get people laughing with us, and we're sort of co-opting them. So it's able to sort of bring people onto our side. We can diffuse conflict that way. So there are many things that humor can do. And in the studies that Brad and I conducted, – we found that humor actually is really intricately linked with power and perceptions of status, that it's almost impossible to disentangle these. And you know, work that Brad has done and work that Brad and I have done together shows that the humor and power are really closely linked.
The idea is that if that the person who has the sense who has a sense of humor is seen as higher status. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So it goes both ways. So first of all, somebody who uses humor successfully is viewed to be more intelligent and to have higher status. It goes the opposite way too, and this is a lot of Brad's work that I should let him jump in here, but that people who are powerful are more likely to use humor. So people in positions of high power are more likely to use it and are more likely to gain those benefits than people who have less power.
Brad, let me pick up on that. And first of all, how important is laughter? I mean, you can be funny, you can tell a joke, you can make light of a situation, but if people aren't laughing, is that successful or unsuccessful?
That is definitely unsuccessful. So in the work that we've done, we found laughter is tremendously important. It's when you tell a joke, you want to make sure that's successful and that your crowd has received it well. And without laughter, then you really haven't accomplished the main goal. So what we find is that when low status individuals actually use humor well, it can have tremendous benefits, which is part of the reason why it's surprising that we find that they don't use it. Because when they use it and people do laugh, they send this signal to us that they're more confident and more competent. And we even see that in the way that we refer to funny people. We call them witty. So they have this benefits that subsequently lead to higher status.
So are you saying that someone with a quote-unquote lower status, so they're not the boss, they're somewhere on the hierarchy, if they have a sense of humor, Brad, they should use it? I mean, know your audience, know your context, but that would be a way of perhaps moving your way through the company?
Absolutely. So they should definitely know their audience. So there are the risks, but they should, after they know their audience, have a sense of what their audience views as appropriate and have a sense of their sense of humor, they should definitely use it, because we find that, yeah, it can make them appear more competent, which is one of the main things that we want to do in the workplace, and can help them actually achieve higher status. And then with the lab, when we've run experiments, we find that the person who's funny and tells an appropriate joke is even more likely to be elected to a leadership position.
Are you funny, Brad?
Am I funny?
Are you a jokester? I mean, do you have a reputation for having a lighthearted touch?
I try to be, but
Maurice is nodding his head. But go ahead. Go ahead, Brad, and then we'll get a second opinion here. But go ahead.
I've been told that, but I think someone would have to be really mean to give me the counterfactual. So I think it's selecting on the dependent variable. So, I mean,
I don't even know what that means. What does that mean?
Oh, I'm only receiving one type of the feedback.
Okay.
I'm not receiving both.
Okay. Well,
I would jump in and say Brad is hilarious. he's in a lot of our studies. Somebody has to come up with the sort of the jokes that we're going to use, and you know, Brad's sort of a fountain of them. In one of our jokes, we have somebody who's auditioning for a chef position to make Mexican food, and says, you know, I'm not very good making Mexican food, but I don't want to taco about it.
T-A-C-O, yeah. About it.
Yeah.
That's called a pun, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, puns are fun jokes. And sort of talked about this idea of a violation. Puns are funniest to people who take language quite seriously. So an English major or somebody that writes for whom the rules of language are really important, and when we violate those rules, these norms about clarity and so on, or we mangle grammar in some way, to those people that represents a violation, and that's why it can be funny.
Right.
So people who speak horribly and don't follow rules anyway, puns just aren't funny. That's just how we speak. But again, we sort of think about this violation idea. And Brad has a gift for finding those violations.
What about anything you want to say, Brad? In your defense?
No, I would say, I'm not sure if this is in my defense or not, but it was definitely a team effort. Maurice is also hilarious. So, I mean, it's been a fun team to work together. And he's definitely been a great resource for coming up with the jokes.
There are people who are not funny. Either they can't tell a joke or they just don't have a sense of humor. Are they somehow disadvantaged? I'll put this to you, Brad, but then to you, Maurice. Are they disadvantaged at work if they're a more serious person?
Well, on one hand, they're avoiding the risks, but on the other hand, they're also not getting the benefits. And that's unfortunate because achieving higher status is really something we dedicate a huge amount of psychological and even financial resources towards. You see people spending thousands of dollars on things such as a Louis Vuitton bag to signal higher status. And right. What we find with humor is that you can actually do the same thing, but at a much cheaper rate.
But if you're not good at it, I mean, there's, a bad joke makes the audience feel, I think, uncomfortable, maybe even, Maurice, sorry for that person because they were, they did the wind up in the pitch and it didn't really land.
Yeah, I think what's sort of interesting are a couple of things. One is, When we make jokes and they don't reach the level of being funny, they're just too benign, it's very painful to the person who's delivering it. To the audience, it's actually something they don't really focus on. And so I think we have this asymmetry in how we think about it. And so I think a lot of people are reticent to tell jokes because they're afraid of them bombing. And they don't realize that, hey, in the workplace, people aren't expecting you to be hilarious. And a few bomb jokes, that's fine. It sort of demonstrates warmth and
does it humanize the person in a way?
I think so. And so I think the second part is that I think the ability to use humor effectively is it's like this muscle. We could practice it. And I think we fail to appreciate how much practice the iconic comedians have. I mean, so think about Robin Williams, who is hilarious. And we often forget that, Mork and Mindy, some of those episodes were kind of tough to watch. I mean, like not all of that humor worked and landed. He really worked and worked and worked at it. And, he was also great, gifted. But there's a lot of work that goes into using humor effectively. And I think a lot of people, afraid of not trying don't get better.
We're almost up in a break here, but are you saying then to our listeners, think about humor, comedy as one of your tools on the job?
Absolutely. It should definitely be part of the toolkit. The one concern is about offending other people. Right. And maybe when we come back, we can talk more about that. But don't be afraid of jokes that fall flat because they're not funny enough.
We are talking about cracking wise at work. That's Maurice Schweitzer, professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Brad Bitterly as well. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Michigan. They have coordinated on some really interesting research about confidence and competence and humor on the job. 1-888-477-9499. We want to hear from you. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Many ways to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're talking about humor at the workplace. How could we not play something from The Office? This is Meredith from The Office reading birthday cards aloud.
Happy birthday. Meredith, good news. You're not actually a year older because you work here where time stands still.
I don't know about that.
That was Stanley. Meredith, happy birthday. You're the best. Love, Pam.
Thanks, Downer.
This is from Michael. Meredith, let's hope the only downsizing that happens to you is that someone downsizes your age.
Because of the downsizing. Rumors. And because you're getting old.
No, I get it. It's funny.
You didn't get the joke. So, that's cool. Actually, I have a bunch of these good ones that I didn't use. What's that? Okay. Here's a good one. Hey, Meredith, Liz Taylor called. She wants her age back and her divorces back. Because Meredith's been divorced, like, twice. Is that right?
Did I get that right?
Okay.
You're right. Yes.
Divorce. Oh, okay. Meredith is so old.
How old is she?
Well, everybody can do it. Meredith is so old.
How old is she?
She's so old, she went into an antique store and they kept her.
All I can say is, ouch. I'm looking at you, Maurice, but I'm sure, Brad, you want to weigh in on this as well. Aggressive humor? Is that what we're hearing here from Michael?
Well, it's definitely painful. So here it's – I mean, what's funny about it for the observers, it's making the observer uncomfortable because, yes. You know, clearly there are all these social cues and you know, somebody's not getting the social –
A clueless boss in
I mean,
this
yeah,
case.
Totally clueless. And you can think about – I mean, power – narrows our perspective taking. We're less good at taking other people's perspectives when we have power. And so the idea about a boss that sort of blithely says things that offends other people is something that we can relate to. And here, yeah, it's so awkward and painful. It becomes funny. I mean, it's sort of funny to
it's
to
funny sort of, for us the
for us the,
for
observer,
the viewers.
Right?
But wait, if you're in the room,
if you're
Brad,
in it,
we hear that fake laughter as the boss tells a really lame joke or even mean joke.
Well, this is it's an interesting example because it brings in Pete McGrath's theory of humor, which is the benign violations theory. So for something to be funny, it needs to violate our expectations, but do so in a way that's not overly threatening. So for the people in that situation, it's just too much of a violation. It's not very funny. For us as the observers, it's awkward, but in a way that's benign because we're actually not – that's not our boss.
No.
So it's actually – we can laugh and we actually view it as funny, but for the people in that situation, it's – we can relate to it, and it's not fun.
Well, and because we know Michael, and we know he's gonna say something really stupid.
Yeah,
that's right.
Let me read some comments. One from Anne Marie. She says, "What about practical jokes among coworkers? My dad hid a slice of Limburger cheese in the hat band of a coworker in a locker in the middle of July. Coworker was not thrilled. Others laughed for years about it." Brad, let me toss that to you. What do you make of that?
Well, I think this actually does tie into this idea of humor being benign violation. So for the person I actually happened to, it was just too much of a violation because they were the butt of the joke. For the outside observers, it was more benign because it was a violation, but it didn't happen to them directly. I think there's a quote by Mel Brooks. Tragedy is when I stub my toe. Comedy is when you fall down a well and die.
Yeah.
So it ties into this idea. If it's happening to someone else, it's more benign and we laugh.
Maurice, it's really about, in many ways, laughing with or laughing at, right?
Yes. As one of the things that Brad's talking about is this sort of psychological distance. So if it's happening to us, it feels very intimate. If it's somebody else, it seems distant. But more broadly, I think the idea, and we think about April Fool's Day sort of at work, humor challenges the hierarchy, it challenges the way we think about things. It's related to creativity, and so we can sort of think differently. And here, what happens when we sort of violate rules at work? And so here, you know, this person sort of contributed this story about something. It isn't how we
right.
do things at work.
Right.
And it can be quite funny. Of course, if it's happening to you, it's more intimate and less so. But it definitely changes the way we think about our relationships and, you know, what we do at work.
Is, though, and we'll say then friendly humor or comedy, is that good for the workplace? I mean, is it good even for the bottom line, Maurice? And then to
I'd
you,
say,
Brad.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's affiliative. It brings people closer together. It makes us feel like we're cooperating. We're on the same team. And so here, humor is one way to co-opt people. And one of the most classic examples, George Bush, when he was president, delivered a commencement address at Yale, and students and faculty staff were protesting him. People had turned their backs to him. And he gets up there and he starts using self-deprecating humor. He starts saying that, you know, to the C students out there, I say you too can become president. And he talks about, you know, using haiku, and people think I don't speak correctly, but I'm, you know, using the ancient rhymes and rhythms of sort of haikus. So he's engaging the self-deprecating humor. People start laughing, and it totally transforms the audience. And I think this idea is representative of what happens when we use humor in a collaborative way. Not to say that we should be mindful of humor that can be used to create separations and to highlight as sort of an in-group and an out-group, but humor can be very, very useful. And you know, Southwest Airlines, I think, you know, so put this as part of their DNA. I mean,
oh, how so?
So in Southwest Airlines, they challenge the idea that the safety announcement of how to put on your seatbelt and the, you know, the masks when they drop off, you know, that used to be this very staid, boring, forgettable part of the flight, and they transformed it into something that was fun and amusing that you might actually pay attention to. And then they, you know, created a friendly experience in a way that I think, you know, changed the relationship between the customer and the flight attendant in a way that was, I think, pretty profound.
Brad, what are your thoughts about self-deprecating humor?
Yeah, we find that it can be tremendously effective. And we find it also can be tremendously effective in situations where you're forced to disclose negative information about yourself that could be quite unflattering. So in those instances, so we all face times where we're asked a direct question that either we don't want to or we can't answer because doing so would require revealing information that could harm perceptions of how warm and likable we are and how competent we are. And what we find is in those instances, actually using humor to disclose the information is more beneficial than disclosing it in a serious manner, because with humor, we infer that what the person is saying is less true, and because of that, the person doesn't take as much of a hit to their interpersonal perceptions.
And if we make ourselves, in a sense, the butt of the joke, then we've really disarmed a lot of people who might want to either criticize us or go after us, Brett.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very true. I remember reading about Joan Rivers was saying that when she was getting her start, it was really tough to be a female comedian, and there were very few targets that were actually safe for her to take on. But by being brutally self-deprecating, it actually made it okay for her to actually tell more jokes.
And it was probably largely about her appearance, knowing what we know about Joan Rivers, right?
Well, it was on all topics. I remember, so it was shockingly, she even made a joke about her husband killing himself, like about like a self-deprecating joke about that. So, I mean, like she took self-deprecating humor to the extreme. But I think she did so because then it actually made it okay for her to target other individuals. She sent the signal that it wasn't that she was being mean-spirited, but she was actually just, she was that way with everyone, even herself.
That's Brad Bitterly. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Michigan, joining us from their studios. Maurice Schweitzer is with us here in our Philadelphia studios. He's a professor of the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about humor in the workplace, something that both of our guests have studied and done research on together. And we want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499. Are you one of those jokesters at work? We want to know if you are, the kind of reception that you get. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Here's an email from Tom. He said, I told a coworker about a bumper sticker that read, elect a clown, expect a circus. He didn't laugh. So I told him it was on a late model car just to smooth things over. An interesting attempt, Maurice.
Yeah, I think again, it represents the idea of, if you think about the psychological distance, that joke is very funny for someone who didn't vote for a clown. If you did vote for the clown, then that hits closer to home, and it might not feel as funny. And so I think it's important to sort of think about our audience. And I think Ellen DeGeneres had a recent experience that I think is quite telling. Here's somebody who's a gifted comic, but when you're delivering comedy in a sort of mass scale, you're invariably going to offend some people because you might cross a line that you didn't think about. And she did that with one tweet where she tweeted herself on the back of Usain Bolt.
Oh, the runner?
The runner. And she just tweeted, this is how I'm getting my groceries done now, or this is how I'm doing my errands. And it, you know, here's a really fast runner, and she sort of looked like she was going to be dashing around. But, you know, given the history here in the United States, it came across as offensive to some people. And here's, I think what's interesting is that here's Ellen DeGeneres, who's really very careful, who's very experienced, and still crossing the line and offending people because it's so hard to really know your audience.
Well, I'm thinking too, Brad, workplaces are so much more diverse than they used to be on just about every criteria that you use. So your audience is a very diverse audience. How much does someone at work have to think about that?
Thinking about your audience, is extremely important. And the fact that you have diverse workplaces, it can make it more difficult because, as Maurice pointed out, here you had Ellen DeGeneres, who is literally a professional and one of the best at telling appropriate humor, and then even she can occasionally miss the mark. So for each of us in the workplace, we have to be extremely careful because perspective taking is really hard, and it's hard to know exactly what's going to offend.
And perspective taking is how whatever you're saying, how that will be perceived.
How it will be perceived by another individual. And it can be very difficult in groups, and it can be very difficult. It's very difficult in general, and it can be very difficult when someone does have a very different background than you, and it's really hard for you to actually know where they're coming from.
Which sometimes raises, Maurice, sort of a hat. So if one is offended by someone at work who delivered a joke that one found offensive, then how do you deal with that?
Well, yeah. So I think so. This is exactly this, you know, elect a clown, expect a circus joke. Yeah, for some people, we're like, hey, that's funny. For other people, it's like, no, that's too
funny.
Close to home. It's not funny. I think we can, you know, talk it through. And then here, I think in this example too, saying, "Oh, it was on a late model car," like you know, sort of joking or trying to soften the blow of it. In your opening clip, you know, sort of, you know, Michael sort of like just digging deeper and deeper and deeper. You know, we should be looking for cues. And as Brad said earlier, one of the biggest cues is laughter. If people are laughing, things are going well. If they're not laughing, things are not going well. We need to be very sensitive to that to figure out, you know, have I missed the mark or is this okay?
Yeah. Clues and cues, right? Being clueless, not knowing your audience.
Exactly.
Or not reading your audience, really.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, in our studies, we actually manipulated whether or not people were laughing. And outside observers are judging jokes to be much funnier when people are laughing, to be more appropriate when people are laughing. So that laughter really is an important signal.
Another comment, this one from Marilyn. She says, jokes might be funny when it's at a distance, but when you're empathetic, a stun at someone else's expense is painful for you too. I'll take that, just build on that, Brad. I mean, these things can feel hurtful if you feel like you're the brunt of a joke, but you don't deserve it. And it feels as if someone was going after you. And I sometimes feel humor has this edge to it. Even really, in fact, in many ways, really good humor has this edge to it.
Yeah, so there's, it's a good point, and it ties into the risk, right? Because a lot of good humor, with the exception of, say, puns, a lot of humor, typically there is a butt of the joke, and what we found is that you really need to be careful to make sure that someone doesn't feel too, Maurice brought up this point, that people don't feel too psychologically close to the target.
Mm-hmm.
So really empathetic people are going to feel really psychologically close to the target of the joke. So as a result, it can be less effective for those individuals.
You're nodding your head, Maurice.
Yeah, so I think that's exactly right. So if you're really empathetic or you feel like you're part of that group, then that joke hits closer to home. And this is why, for example, you know, jokes about things that happened in the distant past are more benign. Jokes about things that happened more recently are fresher and more painful. So how proximal they are in time, how proximal they are to you physically, how much you empathize or are part of that group, those are all things that we think about for the psychological distance. So how close are we psychologically to being the butt of that joke?
Here's an email from Betsy. Did your guest look at all of the development of a sense of humor? Having been a substitute teacher, humor is my best ally. That may be the worst job in the world or the toughest job. It's fascinating how different ages respond to the same types of jokes. There is something about sixth graders developmentally that many jokes just don't work too literal. Brad, you want to pick up on that? And this is using humor as a substitute teacher. And I would think that would be someone's best ally.
I think humor can be your best ally in general. I think as a substitute teacher and dealing with sixth graders, which are, in my mind, one of the most hostile groups, probably. They have a lot going on, which just makes them angry at the world, it seems. Humor can be really effective to diffuse a situation, can actually get people on your side to view you as more confident and competent, as we mentioned before, which is really important when people are forming initial impressions of you and you're in a situation where you need to be able to command the room. So I think it can be really effective for a substitute teacher, as well as everyone in general.
We're almost up on a break here, Maurice. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'll just add that, so here's substitute teachers jumping into a situation. They need to create a quick impression, coming in cold to a group of people. In that setting, humor is a perfect tool for here disarming a group of people. Once the people are laughing with you, you've now brought them onto your side, and now you're able to collaborate on what's next. And so here, substitute teaching, that's a really sharp context for this, but as Brad said, there are many, many domains.
And that's Maurice Schweitzer, who joins us along with Brad Bitterly. We're talking about humor at the workplace. 1-888-477-9499. We've got more comments coming in. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You also can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. We want to hear from you. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me play another clip. This is from Seinfeld. This is George Costanza. He's stuffing his face with shrimp, and he tries to pull off a perfect workplace comeback at a meeting.
You know, George, the ocean called. They're running out of shrimp.
Oh, yeah, Riley? Well, the jerk store called. They're running out of you.
What's the difference? You're their all-time bestseller.
Yeah? Well, I had sex with your wife.
His wife is in a coma.
So a little one-upsmanship there, Brad. Any thoughts?
Yeah, it's just an amazing clip. I remember that episode. It's one of my favorites. Your point is correct. Yeah, there you have a battle of wits. And it can... We've been really interested in how people respond in those situations because you need to... If someone's making a joke, it puts you in a tough situation because if you don't laugh or joke back, you seem like you don't have a sense of humor, and it can really backfire. So your options are either to just laugh along and just concede the point or to joke back. But that can also be risky because then you could get into, like, George, a situation of one-upmanship where you could, escalate to the point that you step over the line.
Exactly. Maurice, any thoughts on that clip?
Well, just again, the line is. And so, joking about, the sort of the shrimp or the jerk store maybe. And then it crosses a line when, the wife's in the coma. And so, there's this escalation. And then, what is funny, it has to be edgy.
Yeah.
But then we have to be careful about stepping over the line, which, definitely happened in that case.
Let me read some more comments. An email from, when my husband and I moved to the Northeast from the South, we both separately observed our colleagues at work were more serious and less funny than we had noticed in the South. Do your guests notice regional differences in how humor is accepted or used at work? A very interesting question. I'll toss that to you first, Maurice.
Yeah, sure. So there are very strong cultural differences, both organizationally and then across different regions. And you know, what we find funny, what the norm is in an organization, even the sort of the microculture within a business unit. So how your specific boss interacts with you matters, and you know that's within the broader organization. So there are a lot of differences, and there are norms about what we joke about, what we don't joke about, and we do want to be sensitive to those norms. Absolutely.
Joanna has a comment saying, I'm a jokey person at work. I have to check myself because I am in a new position, which raises, Brad, the question about status and hierarchy and, you know, what feels appropriate or inappropriate.
So, yeah, so and typically high power individuals do have more latitude in their behavior. So when you're in a low power position, it can feel very constraining and you can feel like you have to be careful of everything that you're doing. And in the work that we've been doing, we do find that all these concerns of how to navigate the environment can actually cause low power individuals to experience greater cognitive load. So they have more things on their mind, which can then inhibit their ability to actually use humor, which is unfortunate because it still does have those benefits, especially for new employees trying to make a new impression.
Are you saying go ahead, use the humor and you know, work your way in, or be careful, Brad?
I'm saying as long as she has a good read of the environment and what's appropriate, which is depends on her particular situation, if she does have a good read. If she does have a good read, then I'd say absolutely. And the other thing I'd say is, and a lot of times we view humor as needing to be spontaneous, but I think that's more in the delivery. A lot of times we can actually think about the jokes that we're going to be saying. So say she has a presentation coming up, she's going to be thinking about all the things that she's saying. She can also plan her jokes and also just run them by people who can give her feedback to let her know if it's appropriate.
Here's an email from CJ. What I have found is that good humor and funny comments are seen as a plus for men, but a minus for women. I have a healthy sense of humor and enjoy zinging one-liners, but I have really stopped because I've been told it makes me seem like less of a leader, even though men are doing exactly the same thing and getting kudos. Very interesting from CJ. What do you think, Maurice?
That's an interesting comment. I do feel as if the latitude for men and women is different in terms of norms and expectations. In other research that Brad and I have done with some colleagues, we found that there are gender differences. We actually find that women are laughing more. Now, some of that laughter is the nervous kind of laughter, and we observe this both in Gallup poll data and in speed dating data. Where women are laughing more, even at things that aren't funny. And men do have a sort of a wider range. But we find that many of the benefits of effectively using humor redound both to men and to women. So there are benefits for both men and women to effectively using humor.
Is that, Brad, just picking up what Maurice just said there, is that because women are maybe a better audience?
Well, what we believe is what is going on with the laughter is that it's actually driven by power dynamics. So very frequently socially and historically, unfortunately, women have tended to be in a lower power role. And the expectation has actually been of them that they should laugh more. And what we've done is we've run an experiment where we've manipulated power and have actually found when women are in the high power role, they fascinatingly, they stop laughing more.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. As they work their way up, there's less of a need, I would say, to be that receptive audience.
Exactly.
Let me read another email. This one from Mary Beth. I'm an adjunct English professor at two universities in the Philadelphia area. Then she says, that's not a joke. I like to use humor in the classroom because it eases the tension between me as the authority and my students. Brad, picking up on what our sixth grade substitute teacher said.
So as far as with What we find is that humor can be beneficial at all levels. So it can be beneficial at the university level. It can be beneficial for the sixth grade students as well. So ultimately, although you do have to be aware of your environment. So different audiences might view things as it can shift the appropriateness, what's perceived as an appropriate joke or an inappropriate joke. The benefits can actually occur in all environments.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'll just add to that psychologists have long known that they have to quickly gain the trust of other people around them. And one way we can do this is by making ourselves vulnerable or making some mistake. And one pratfall we can engage in is making a bad joke. So if we come in a position of authority or high power and we want to make ourselves more approachable to others, here a bad, you know, a joke that lands flat, that's what I mean by a bad joke,
sure,
makes us more approachable to others. It sort of opens up a line of communication and makes it easier for us to engage with other people.
There is a congressman running in, I'm not sure which district or even which state, but he made a quote-unquote joke saying that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had been groped by Abraham Lincoln. What are we to make of that, Maurice?
So yeah, that happened in South Carolina, and this congressman was, I think what's important is that he was at a fundraising event, so he was reading his audience. And his audience was receptive to that kind of humor. And when it leaked out of that audience, it was offensive to a broader community. So this idea about, you know, who's the audience and where's the line? And, you know, he's picking up on this theme of accusations of sexual misconduct. He's also making a joke about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's age. So these are, you know, again, to how close you identify with the target of the joke. And if you have psychological distance, it's funnier. The violation's funnier. If you're closer, it's less funny.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm thinking, I don't want to get too mired in politics here, Rob. Brad, but sorry about that.
Oh, no worries.
I feel like calling your guest by the wrong name. But Rosenstein apparently, and this is the story of du jour over the weekend before it got sidelined by another story, but anyway, that he was joking when he said, well, we should all wear a wire, when I, you know, go in to talk to President Trump. Now, was he joking? Was he not joking? I have no idea, but it shows you how loaded an environment that we live in.
Absolutely. Well, it shows you how it can be this tool where people use it to reduce the perceived veracity of their statements and where they can use it to make a comment but then disclose the information in a way that could cause them to actually be viewed as more favorable. Now, the other part of that is, as Marie said, your audience is going to matter a lot. We've run studies where we've actually recruited people who are either Trump supporters or were Hillary Clinton supporters. And what we find is drastically different effects of the same joke depending on who, based off of which group the person actually belongs to.
I wonder, though, whether there, and I'll put this to you, Maurice, whether some people use humor to as a defense or to way to a way of deflecting criticism or as a way of kind of messing up the interaction.
Yeah, well, it's going to be enormously disarming. And my favorite example of this is actually from the Reagan-Mondale debate in 1984. At the time, Reagan was the oldest person running for office at the age of 73. And there were some concerns. We now know in hindsight he was being a sufferer from Alzheimer's. But on the campaign trail and in the prior debate, he had been fumbling for words and had pauses where he seemed like he was a little bit lost. And age was an issue. And the moderator asked him a question about his age and if he had the stamina for this position. And in his response, he said, "I won't make age an issue in this campaign. I won't use my opponent's youth and inexperience to exploit for political gain." That joke completely disarmed the question. The audience was laughing, the moderator's laughing, and importantly, Mondale starts laughing. And that from there, that issue got put to rest, and they moved on to every other issue. And you know, Reagan won with a huge margin,
and I think, and delivered with such precision.
It was great. I mean, and this is again, you know, related to a point that Brad made. You don't have to. You don't have to be spontaneous. That is, Reagan clearly planned this out. He practiced it, and he delivered it terrifically well in a way that completely disarmed this line of attack.
Here's an email from Hannah who says, I think that telling a joke requires a certain comfort with taking center stage in a way that is often not something women or other groups that have been marginalized feel comfortable doing in the workplace. That's interesting. Brad, what are your thoughts?
I think that's absolutely true. So we even have some data from organizational communication. So we took a look at the use of humor in an Enron email data set. So during the government's investigation into Enron, they actually leaked this corpus of emails dating from 97 to 2001. And when we look at the use of humor in it, we actually find women are using it at a lower rate than men. Now, I think to her point is that there's these historic power dynamics that we were talking about before going on, where women tend to have historically been in lower power roles and as a result have been more cognizant of trying to avoid doing things that could actually be viewed as inappropriate. But we do find that humor, as long as it's appropriate, can be an effective tool for people who are in low power positions to signal that they're very confident and competent. And in studies that we've run, we find that the benefits can be for women as well.
Here's an email from Hillary. I remember sending a joke about why the chicken crossed the road with various religions. A coworker whose husband was Muslim got offended and even gave me the silent treatment for a while. It was shortly after 9/11. I didn't mean to offend anyone and apologize to the coworker. It made me pause when it comes to jokes unless I know the people well enough. I mean, right?
Yeah. Again, I think, you know, the audience matters and there's a sensitivity to it. And, you know, for us, perspective taking is always hard. Mm-hmm. And I think here, this person did exactly the right thing. They sort of monitored those cues. They reacted. They sort of noticed that it made somebody uncomfortable and then apologized. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm sure that the long-term harm was quite small. And I think we should be taking some risks. That is, humor is risky, but if we monitor it closely, we can, you know, really sort of gain the benefits and reduce the downside risks.
And own it. Here's a tweet from Eve. I found that when I'm approaching burnout status at work, that I start joking more often at work, and it's more snarky than anything else. It is, Brad, in many ways, we're almost out of time here, a stress reliever, right, to let off steam through a joke?
Yeah, prior work has actually found that humor can be a really effective method of increasing positive affect and reducing stress, both in yourselves and in others. So it makes complete sense that to try to boost her own positive affect that she would actually be using humor.
Well, Brad Bitterly, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Michigan, joining us from their studios. Maurice Schweitzer, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, thank you.
You're very welcome. Professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. And we have been talking about some of the work that they have been doing, some of the research they've been doing having to do with humor and how humor can enhance a person's status and influence how others perceive their confidence and competence. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.